to help us understand better some things about the virtues of chastity and especially modesty. Let us reflect on some thoughts in a parable form. To begin with, let us think of ourselves as being in Spokane, Washington, and we are up on the south hill of the Priory of Jesus Crucified, and there we observe the bishop setting out with others who are leaving with him at that time on a pilgrimage toward Europe. We know the people at the airport like you to check in plenty early in order to check through your luggage and all such necessary things. And this time the bishop and those going with him on the pilgrimage do leave the priory in plenty of time to arrive at the airport to fulfill the requests of those who are in charge. But on their way toward the airport, coming down Altamont Street, just where you pass under the freeway, they see this terrible accident. Two young men had been drag racing in their cars. They ran through a red light and smashed into a van load of the religious sisters. Some of the sisters were seriously injured, and therefore some of the priests in the bishop's car got out quickly and ministered to them even the sacrament of extreme unction before the ambulance came and took them to the hospital. And this, of course, delayed the bishop and those going with him to the airport. Because they had left the priory in plenty of time, they could still make it to the airport. However, another problem arose. They found that now they had a flat tire. Their brother driving the bishop's car was not going on the pilgrimage, but only taking them to the airport. He fixed the tire as quickly as possible, and then, because they were running late, he was driving the car about 10 miles per hour over the speed limit. One of the friendly policemen there stopped him. The brother tried to explain to the policeman why he was speeding, because they were late. The friendly policeman replied, "Yes, brother, I understand. I will write this ticket just as fast as I can." So taking his time, he wrote the brother a ticket and said, "Here is your citation. Since I am going toward the airport, I will just kind of trail along behind you to see that you do not lose your way." Divine Providence arranged things so that there was a delay in the aircraft that was leaving on the pilgrimage, and therefore the bishop and those with him made it aboard on time and left for Europe. But the brother who took them to the airport returned back to Spokane. That same day, there was another accident in Spokane. There was another young man who stole a super sports car, such as a Jaguar. He was racing over 100 miles per hour through a residential area with the policeman chasing him. He lost control and came smashing right through a school yard. He outright killed about 12 little children, first and second graders. The children were out in the schoolyard playing. He also injured a great many others before he finally got the car stopped and was arrested. A week later, the brother who was driving the bishop's car and the two men that were drag racing and the other fellow that stole the car and killed the children all had to appear before the same judge. The brother that was driving the bishop's car explained to the judge why he was speeding. He explained all the circumstances of what they did when they stopped for the accident. And the judge, hearing all the evidence, even commended the brother for stopping and doing what they could before the ambulance arrived, saying that the people were taken care of to the best of their ability. The judge understood about the flat tire running over the glass from the accident, and he did not even receive a fine from the judge. He, so to speak, was even praised by the judge for what they did. The two men that were drag racing that crashed into the van load of sisters received a much more severe penalty from the judge because of the violations they had made and the people they had injured. Their fine was very heavy. How much of a fine and punishment do you think the judge would give to the young man that stole the car and killed the school children? What do you think the parents thought of the little children that were killed and the others that were injured? They were ready to inflict every type of punishment on that young man that the human mind could imagine because of him killing their little innocent children. Now, let us apply these principles to the spirit of purity and modesty. We could distinguish that there is a difference between a fault, a venial sin, and a grave mortal sin. If a man should see a woman very modestly dressed, such as a religious in her full habit, conduct herself in a very Mary-like manner, she should not arouse any immoral thoughts or passions in that man. In fact, such a lady, such a woman, such a religious shows forth part of God's beauty. If someone should have evil thoughts and think immoral things about that religious nun, although she did nothing on her part to excite those thoughts whatsoever, then when she stands before God in judgment day, she will not be found guilty for his evil thoughts. Then you observe another female walking along the sidewalk. She is wearing slacks and a tight sweater. Her clothes seem to be so tight and revealing that it looks as if she was poured into them. She can set down in her natural skin, her birthday suit, but she cannot always sit down in such tight clothing without tearing it. Anyway, her clothes are tight, and they certainly show her form and figure. Her going around in public that way is more serious and more offensive to God than the two boys that were drag racing, crashed into the van, and injured other people. Maybe this female does have on slacks and a blouse that covers most of her flesh, but it is so tight and form revealing, any males that see her are easily aroused to immoral thoughts and desires. Spiritually speaking, she causes many spiritual accidents, and not only injury, but she causes death to many men who see a female dressed in such a way. Is it possible to go downtown in any major city, go into a store, grocery store, Walmart, Kmart, any department store, and not see women wearing dresses that do not reach to their knees, to see women wearing blouses that expose a great part of their chest? Their arms are not covered. The back is maybe exposed. And even if their clothes are not really super tight fitting, do they not suggest to men who see them that they may wish to have evil thoughts and desires? They run around in shorts, exposing their legs and exciting the lust of men to them. Are they doing more damage than the two boys that were drag racing and crashed into the van? When everyone comes before judge, our judge on General Judgment Day, who will receive the most severe penance? Those who were drag racing and injured the sisters in the van, or those women who murdered so many souls through their immodesty? And it's not that unfrequent that you will even see women wearing very short shorts, exposing about 80 to 90% of their body, their flesh, for others to view. The cheerleaders and gals that perform in parades, twirling batons and pom-poms, turning upside down, standing on their hands, with hundreds or thousands of people watching them at the place they perform or on television. Are they not an occasion of sin? Consider a female dressed in such a unmodest way, and she walks by a boys' high school or any other place where there are a group of males. Do you not see the comparison? She quickly murders. She puts to death. She kills the spiritual souls of multitudes of those who see her. How many countless mortal sins does she occasion in thoughts, in desires, and in actions? If not actions right then, probably later. Which is worse, to kill the physical bodies of those little first and second grade children, or to kill and cast into hell the souls of thousands of God's little children? The men, young and old, who see the females dressed like harlots, and much worse than the harlots dressed in the time of our Lord, or until this century probably, when the female walked past the school grounds or where there were other men or boys, did she not cause heinous, horrible death to multitudes? And others did not consent and commit mortal sin at the time. And in other words, they were not killed on the spot, but they were definitely injured, and a great many of them. And it's very likely they will die later when they are tempted and those thoughts come back repeatedly. Eventually they may consent and commit a mortal sin and die spiritually speaking. Indeed, they were hurt, and they will die anyway, many of them. You will not convince myself, at least, that females dressed in that way are not an occasion of sin. Pope Leo XIII and others tell us very plainly, human nature does not change. Again, we are reminded of the teachings of Holy Mother the Church. If you do anything in thought, word, deed, or omission that is an occasion of sin to others, unnecessarily, you are guilty of a sin of scandal. And if it is a serious matter, then it is a mortal sin of scandal. So we see that not only on her soul are many sins of scandal, but what will be said of the females who go down through a residential area today, or go downtown where people are shopping and there are thousands of people coming around and viewing them? How will they excuse themselves before God, especially when they go to the public beaches or to swimming places where they have mixed swimming? They must certainly cause the spiritual death of many. What do you think the parents believe, that is, God our Father in heaven and Mary our mother, when people keep murdering their children? Mary had her divine son Jesus, the Redeemer of the world, but on Calvary she was given to us as our mother. We are all her spiritual children. How sorrowful Mary must be. What an offense against our Father in heaven. What does the Sacred Heart of Jesus feel when people ruthlessly slaughter their children, crucifying into themselves again the Lord Jesus Christ by the way they act what they say and how they conduct themselves. Be not deceived, for God is not mocked. He who looks with lust upon a woman has already committed adultery with her in his heart. And no adulterer shall enter into the kingdom of heaven. Have you reflected upon the gospel that is read on the second Sunday of Advent? It is taken from St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 11, beginning with verse 2. Now when John had heard in prison the works of Christ, sending two of his disciples, he said to him, Art thou he that art to come, or look we for another? And Jesus, making answer, said to them, Go and relate to John what you have heard and seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise again, the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he that shall not be scandalized in me. Can that same be said of each of us? Blessed is he that shall not be scandalized in me. Are we an occasional scandal to others? Remember that we are guilty of scandal just by offering someone an unnecessary occasion to sin, even if we wish that person not to sin, and even if they do not consent and commit sin. We are guilty of scandal whenever we offer the occasion to sin. This gospel continues in verse 7. And when they went their way, Jesus began to say to the multitudes concerning John, What went you out into the desert to see? A reed shaken with the wind? We know that reeds grow where it is marshy, where it is wet, around ponds, where the ducks live. That is not what you normally find out in a desert, or as one of the fathers of the church explains it, a reed easily bends whichever way the wind is blowing. It just gives way and bends, tips over according to whatever way the wind blows. And then he compares that to a carnal man. Whatever their passions desire, they bend and give in to their passions. One thing the people knew, St. John the Baptist was not a carnal man. He was one who exercised great fortitude. He did great penance. He had his body, his passions under control. That's the one thing you might say he is known for among many others, but that is certainly the saint that the church knows as one who did penance, who had his passions under control. He was not shaken like a reed in the wind, following the lusts and desires of his passions. Is it wrong to think that, somewhat as in sarcasm, Jesus was kind of like smirking at these people, ridiculing them? If you're looking in the desert, do you expect to find many ponds, ducks, and reeds? But what went you out to see? A man clothed in soft garments? Behold, they that are clothed in soft garments are in the houses of kings. At the time that Jesus Christ and St. John the Baptist lived, and St. John the Baptist did his preaching at the River Jordan, can you not picture one of these Pharisees, some of these Jews, saying to another what they had heard and seen and learned from St. John the Baptist? Certainly they did not tell each other that St. John the Baptist was a man clothed in soft garments. He was not sitting around in soft linens and silk and acting as if he were a royal king and everyone had to wait upon him. It seems that Jesus Christ is kind of using sarcasm to these Pharisees and the people who ridicule everything that explains goodness, truth, and beauty. To put it in more modern, everyday street talk of our age, it was not improper anything wrong to say so. Jesus was saying to them, come on, friend, talk me some sense. I know you did not go out to the desert to see a man living in soft garments, a life of ease and comfort. If we would reflect upon Jesus walking on earth today, do you not think we might hear him say the same words? Come on, man, talk me some sense. When he sees the ridiculous, contradictory ways people live, according to the gospel truth. What do I mean by this? Maybe some examples will make the point more clear. Go into a home where they have a sliding glass window, and then, in the evening usually, they pull the drapes, slide the curtains together so that you cannot see in or out of that window. So consider a home that has a sliding glass door in it, and the glass is washed so very clean that you might have to walk up and lightly tap it to see if it is there and not broken out. You are living inside of that room, that home with a sliding glass door, and then you decide and consent that you are going to commit some very serious, shameful sin. Outside of your home, there's a vast multitude of people looking in through that glass door or through a glass window. They may be your parents, your children, your minister, people who are known for goodness and honesty in the town where you live. So what do you do when you are ready to commit your shameful sin? You walk over and slide the glass door shut. You close the sliding window so that they will not see you. Come on, man, talk me some sense. They will see through that clean glass door or that clean window as if it was not even there. And yet, how many times do we foolishly go and commit sins, saying, well, God does not see me. I will shut myself off from his sight. People will not see what I do on General Judgment Day, when we are told very specifically that's the purpose of General Judgment. Everyone will see what everyone else since Adam and Eve has done. Sure, man, come on, talk me some sense. There is no place we can go to hide from God. As the psalmist says, if I go to the depth of the sea, he is there. Even the darkness is like light unto God. God knows and sees everything. If it was not for God, we would not exist for the teeniest moment. Certainly, we are never alone, even if we think we are. God is ever with us, keeping us in existence. And we always have an angel ever at our side. What would you think if you went downtown and saw a man on the street corner who remained on the sidewalk while the green light was in his favor to walk across the street? When it turns to the red light and he should remain on the sidewalk, then is when he jumps off of the curb. Is that fellow living according to right reason? You go up and ask him, what are you doing that for? He says, oh, I like to see the drivers slam on their brakes and swerve to dodge me. Sure, man, come on, talk me some sense. Sooner or later, one of those drivers will not swerve and dodge him. Yet that is the way we seem to live. The red and the green lights are God's laws and commandments. They are an indication showing us how to live according to right reason. God's commandments are as road signs showing us the way to get to heaven, to play it safe, how to be wise and prudent and holy. Every time we break one of God's commandments, it is like the man going against the red light, jumping out in front of swift-moving traffic. You're putting yourself in a very serious occasion to be banged up or even killed. and maybe suffer eternally in hell. And yet, how often do we not observe parents, guardians, and those in custody of others willfully obliging their children to go down into the big towns by themselves? And not only in the big towns, but in the little villages. They send their children where there are many occasions of sin. They send their children down to just wander around in the streets, to associate with bad companions, which always corrupt the good morals. How foolish they are. And yet the parents themselves are often the occasion of sin to their children, to their spouse, and to others. Consider the 9 ways we assist others to commit sin. As this gospel says, "Blessed is he that is not scandalized in me." Now that gets to be very serious when we think of what the church teaches in this regard of offering scandal to others. The word or the action is not the cause of the sin. It is only an occasion to sin. Then I am guilty of sin. Remember that if the spiritual harm, the occasion you offer to others, is serious, then the sin of scandal is a mortal sin. Otherwise, it probably may only be a venial sin, but nevertheless, it is a sin. It is not necessary that our neighbor actually commit sin. He may resist the occasion. We sin by offering him the occasion of spiritual harm. It is not necessary that we intend his harm or wish him to sin. Of course, if we do wish him to sin, then we have additional sins on our own soul. We commit the diabolical double crimes and offenses against God. Even if we wish him not to sin, we commit a sin of scandal. If we do anything, there will be an occasion of spiritual harm to our neighbor. The sin of scandal is committed if we say or do anything that is an occasion of sin to another. I do not need to start listing the sins that are obviously committed in public every day of the year. I do not need to run down any class of people or any such thing. We all know that people are offering occasions of sin to others. In the nightclubs, in the other daily scenes you see, in the stores, in the streets, in the homes, in the schools, in the religious houses, wherever you go, there seems to be serious violations against the will of God. How can we live the kind of life that we live day after day and then truly examine our conscience and not think we are an occasion of sin to others? For example, how many people work on Sundays as if it was just another day of the week? How can they keep the third commandment? Remember to keep holy the Lord's day. Or the other fellow across the way, running his machinery, washing his cars, mowing his lawns, building his house, all the things going on. How is that not an occasion of sin to their children and to others who observe them? Are they observing the Sunday obligation to keep holy the Lord's day when apparently they pray no prayers? They just stay home, watch TV, drink their beer, smoke their cigarettes, take their drugs, and read bad books, play immoral video games? Are they not offering occasions of sin to others, especially to even the members of their home, their children? Come on, friend, listen to God. Talk me some sense. If parents saw their child about to get caught in a flood or to be burned, would not the parents even risk their life to go and try and save that child? Most parents would. Yet they see their children in occasions of sin, ready to be plunged into the eternal fires of hell, and they push them on in instead of trying to rescue them. They send their daughter out of the house, dressed more like a harlot than a virgin and child of Mary, dressed very immodest, taking her to the dance. Not only do the parents approve of their daughter going to the dance, they take her there and stay there and watch their children, or rather, they neglect to watch them in reality. Yes, come on, talk me some sense. Say a man came to your door, say one of your relatives. Tonight, just after it gets dark, he comes along and just very lightly taps on the door, trying to get in, to be invited to come in. Or maybe it's the friend across the street came to give you a message. Say your garage out back is on fire. Yet, because they tap very lightly on the door, no one inside hears them. Maybe the ones inside are just having a party or playing loud music, have the TV turned up high, or just chattering in a loud tone of voice, and no one hears the friend and the guest and the neighbor at the door lightly tapping, wanting to come in to give you a very important message or just to visit for the evening. So what will you think if the next day or the end of the week your friend or your neighbor or your relation has to call you up and say, I was there to visit you. I was there to tell you your garage was on fire, but no one would let me in. I had to go away sad. I stayed out there in the piercing bitter cold for hours knocking on your door, and no one would listen. No one would let me come in. And so it is in the spiritual life. Jesus Christ is knocking at the door of our heart always, asking us to let him in, to talk with him, to visit him, to let him be the guest of our soul. And yet, how often we turn him away. How does Jesus knock at the door of our soul? Through the everyday occurrence of our existence, such as this tape you are now listening to. Maybe you celebrate your birthday or some other friend or relation in the family. There is a warning of God knocking at the door of your heart. Friend, you're over the hill now. You're going up in years. You're 365 days closer to your judgment and eternity. What are you doing with the precious gift of time? What are you doing for eternity? What are you doing to save souls? Or maybe you're out walking and you stumble over the sidewalk or slip on some rocks and you fall. You just get very slightly bruised. Do you thank Jesus Christ and the holy angels for protecting you? Do you take that as a warning that Jesus is knocking at your door? Do you hear Jesus saying to you, you are my property. I am protecting you. I saw to it that you were not bruised worse than you are. Do you thank me for that? How easily you might have sprained your ankle or broken a bone. And then what would you be doing? Suffering and probably cursing me. Yes, Jesus is always knocking at our heart, but how seldom we seem to listen. You drive your car and you have a close call of an accident. Someone else runs a red light and almost crashes into you. Do you see that and hear Jesus knocking at your door? Do you realize how he and his angels protected you? Say again that you were in your house and your friend or neighbor came and lightly tapped on the door to tell you the message that your garage out back was on fire. Would you not really appreciate it if he really rapped on that door and made himself known that he was there, that he had something important to tell you? Would you be offended if he even broke the glass and came in and said, your garage is on fire and your house is about to catch on fire? At least then you would have a chance to save the more important things out of your house before it went up in smoke and ashes. I would think that we would thank that neighbor for helping us out and telling us that important message. Sometimes it seems that God has to kick down the door and knock that block out of our mind, wake us up in a harsh and sudden way, strike us down with a severe accident, a serious illness, or some such thing. We should thank God for that. He is trying to save the more important thing, our immortal souls. Yet, when most people receive that definite warning, they begin to fight and argue and curse that man who was rapping hard on their door and who maybe even knocked out their glass and came in to tell them that their garage or their barn was on fire and their house was about to catch on fire, or that their relative is dying and asking for them to come quickly. God strikes them with some illness, and they do not ever resign themselves to the workings of divine providence. They never see the kind hands of God and his loving care and protection. The very wound, the illness, is what saved St. Ignatius of Loyola. After that, St. Ignatius went on to found the Jesuit order. Then we can read what just one of his disciples, one Jesuit priest, did, St. Francis Xavier. St. Francis Xavier baptized hundreds of thousands. He raised more than 24 people from the dead. He converted the entire nations, and so much more with all the miracles that continue to be worked through his intercession. God struck down St. Ignatius, and look at the results from just one of his apostles, one of his followers, St. Francis Xavier, let alone the work of the North American martyrs in converting the Indians and the hundreds of others who have entered the Society of Jesus. God knows what he is doing. Come on, friend, talk me some sense. Listen to what God has to say in our lives. Have you ever observed a candle, such as the sanctuary lamp? Have you seen one burned maybe about 3/4 of the way down? And then you might notice there was a moth stuck to the side of that candle. Although the moth does not have reasoning, as human beings are supposed to have, but we might say he was not very smart, was he? The moth flew over the top of that sanctuary lamp, being attracted by the light, and he felt the heat from the candle coming out there. Then he says, I am going to trust in my own great ability to fly back out of there. And I am going down there to see what that little flickering flame is all about. That is the same way the world is to us. It has very many little bright and flickering, flashing neon signs and amusements. Our conscience warns us, like the heat warned the moth. Our passions rise, and we are told by our angel, that is a dangerous place to go into, friend. Stay out of there. Yet we trust in our own great ability to save our immortal souls, having placed ourselves in unnecessary occasions to sin. We go down into the world, into bad company, without any legitimate reason. And what happens? It is just like the moth. He got stuck in the wax and roasted on the side of that candle. We get stuck in the world and roast for all of eternity. Come on, friend, talk me some sense. When you get the warning from your angel to stay out, listen. Don't go down into the occasions of sin, or you are going to get stuck and roast forever in hell. Or if we reflect upon the insane false religions, It would be very humorous in some ways if it was not such a sad reality of what happens in the end. We know the apostate church also now teaches evolutionism as a fact, not as something you may accept or reject. How many people are there in the world today that teach evolution as a fact? Why is that? Because if they can accept evolution, it gives them a free license to do whatever their passions desire. They may then live according to the way their fallen nature and their passions draw them. If there is no original sin, and that is what belief in evolution does away with, then there is no reason to keep any of God's laws and commandments. That's what it all boils down to. Come on, friend, talk me some sense. How much logic does evolution make? Think about it for a while. There is that great, big, hairy, muscle-bound, ignorant baboon swinging through the trees. There's a whole herd of those baboons swinging through the trees. The one day the leader of the pack, or one of them at least, loses his grip, and then he slips. He falls on his head, and then he said, "Hip, hip, hooray, I'm a man today." Do you think that is the way the first baboon, the first ape, the first monkey became a man? He was swinging through the trees. He bumped his head, and then he said, "Hip, hip, hooray, I'm a man today. I finally realized the facts of life." Now that this baboon recognizes that he is a man, what is he going to do? "I am a man, but now I need to find myself a mate. If I am a man, what am I going to call the mate, and who will I choose?" So the talking parrot up there in the tree says, "There's a lot of those female baboona to select from." And so this baboonist man says, "You're right, there are a lot of those baboona out there to select from. What? Now I have a serious problem. I have to choose one of them, and what will I call her?" So the parrot up there says, "Who, man? Who, man? Who, man?" So the baboonist man says, "That's it. I'll call her a woman." And now that baboonist man ape got himself a woman. He selected one among the great herd of baboonas. And now this baboonist man and his baboona woman are going to get together and have all those critters known as the humans. And that's the way evolution began. Come on, man, talk me some sense. And yet, that's a fact that people believe. They accept that that's the way they came into existence. One day the ape baboon was a swinging through the trees, and then he became a man, found himself a woman, and started us humans. Sure, friend, talk me some sense. It's almost as ridiculous as those who believe in reincarnation. So you are invited to listen to the next tape in this series, Who is Right and Who is Wrong, to see if the housefly and the mosquito can talk us some sense as they teach us some lessons about patience and reincarnation, as well as a number of other parables and stories and information.